Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Tulsa Opera presents the Oklahoma premiere of Robert Aldridge's operatic adaptation of the classic Sinclair Lewis novel Elmer Gantry this weekend, the story of the rise of an unscrupulous, charismatic charmer who finds fortune and destruction in the American evangelical movement of the 1920s. Performance dates are Friday evening at 7:30 and Sunday afternoon at 2:30 in the Chapman Music Hall of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. The opera, which is only in its third professional production, features Keith Ferris as Gantry. Ferris originated the role in the opera's premiere at Nashville Opera. Kristen Chavez as evangelist Sharon Falconer. Matthew DiBattista as the vengeful Eddie Fisslinger. And Elizabeth Fishburne as the jilted Lulu Baines. Artistic director Kostis Protopapas conducts. My guest today is Tulsa Opera stage director Christine McIntyre. McIntyre has made regular appearances at many of America's top regional opera houses, including Tulsa Opera, and has directed world premiere productions for Lyric Opera of Kansas City, as well as new productions for Pittsburgh Opera, Austin Lyric Opera, the Skylight Opera Theater, Des Moines Metro Opera, and Kentucky Opera. She joins us today to talk about Tulsa Opera's latest production, Elmer Gantry. Christine McIntyre, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This opera, Elmer Gantry, this is a work that was written a number of years ago, but it's just taken a long time to finally get a production going. And once it's got a production, it won 2 Grammy Awards. And now Tulsa Opera is the third company to do a production of this piece. What attracted you particularly to this piece?
I love new American opera. I think it's so important to keep revitalizing the art form by doing new works, and specifically about doing work that relates to things that Americans care about. It's based on a great book. I have a degree in English literature, so I'm always up for anything that's based on a great novel. And the fact that it's really, really great music. It's an incredibly entertaining piece. Feels a little bit like musical theater in the best sense of that term. Feels a little bit cinematic in the best sense of that term. So I think it draws in a lot of musical styles that I really enjoy.
How much do you think it's influenced by film? There was a wonderful film adaptation.
I think very much. And I think that Bob Aldridge is very honest in talking about the genesis of the opera in terms of being aware of the film, obviously basing it on the book, but then also being very aware of religion in America, the revivalist spirit. They did a lot of research incognito, going around to different churches and exploring where American religion is at and what it means, and trying to incorporate some of that music into the idiom of the piece itself.
Of course, this was written in the 1920s. It spoke to that particular generation, but nothing much has really changed.
No, it's actually remarkable. And at some places, if you took out religion and inserted politics, you would find that it could be ripped from the headlines of today. No, not a lot has changed in terms of the confluence between money, influence, and religion in America. Sinclair Lewis was very prescient. There's a reason he won the Nobel Prize in Literature for his work, and I think it's quite appropriate that his satirical criticisms stay part of our language.
Now, when you have a piece like this, that pretty new opera, do you go back to source material? Do you go back to the original novel?
Absolutely. Everyone in the cast read the book. I studied the book, watched the movie. And then there's other source material. You know, Amy Semple McPherson, the 20th century American revivalist, was the model for Sharon Falconer. So there's a great PBS documentary about her. There are YouTube clips of her actually preaching. And so we've been using all of that kind of research. Huge amounts of photographic research have gone into how we set up the visual look of the scenes. In terms of creating character, but also just the feeling of what each of these places should be.
For those who don't know the story of Elmer Gantry is a young college student at the beginning of the opera. Mm-hmm. He's at a seminary, a college and seminary, a Bible college, if you will. He's a football player, and he's...
He's sort of the football star of the school.
He's the football star, and he's also the big man on campus, if you will, and he doesn't mind telling people about that.
Indeed.
And then he meets Lulu, who is engaged to Eddie, but Elmer steps in the middle of it. They have a little affair, but as some college affairs often happen, it's over. And they move on with their lives, and then Elmer is, I guess, selling hardware or something like that.
Farm implements for the Pequod Farm Company.
Yeah. And he happens upon this revivalist, Sharon Falconer, and he's entranced.
The moment he sees her, Lewis writes in the book that from the moment he sees Sharon, his meaningless life suddenly has purpose and she becomes his religion. And it's really interesting because he is not only wowed by a physical attraction to her, but also by the fact that she's incredibly good at what she does. That all of the people in the revival tent are as wowed by her as he is. And he wants in on whatever that is.
Yeah.
And he asks her for a job.
So it's ambition and love and
love,
lust.
All bound up together, which makes for a very powerful force.
And eventually they find each other.
They fall in love. He becomes part of the organization and he begins preaching with her. And he actually takes her revivalist organization into new and more modern directions. There's a wonderful scene in which they're putting together the tabernacle and Elmer starts talking about all the things they could do. They could do it on the radio, he says, revivals. We could drop flyers out of planes. And you think this is the 1910s and the 1920s. So these are all really new and modern ideas of how to market religion.
Mm-hmm. And eventually their plans are foiled through a bit of a revenge plot between Lulu and Eddie.
Indeed. Eddie and Lulu have contrived to entrap Elmer in a renewed affair with Lulu, and they actually have photographic evidence of it. And in the middle of the opening of Sharon's new tabernacle, they come and confront Elmer in the hopes of discrediting him and kind of taking down the revival movement.
Yeah, and like any good opera diva, mm-hmm. Sharon goes down with a ship.
She does indeed. Something very unexpected and untoward happens. The tabernacle catches fire and everyone burns to death.
Exactly. But unlike opera heroes, Elmer lives to...
He lives to sing another day.
Yes, he does.
There are only two people that escape. T.J. Rigg, who is the sort of almost Warren Buffett-esque financier who sort of has backed the whole thing. And Elmer, who actually moves on. And one of the sort of interesting themes in Lewis's book is the fact that Elmer is basically made out of Teflon. Nothing sticks to him. And he is constantly able to weather any crisis in his life and move forward from it.
It's on to the next...
On to the next religious movement called New Thought.
Yeah. Well, in this production, you're very lucky in having the original Elmer Gantry.
Keith Ferris.
Keith Ferris, who's, I guess, done it
all the times that it's been done. Keith has done it, and he's on the Grammy-winning recording.
Yeah.
So he knows the role like no other. He's very good friends with both the composer and the librettist. So that's a really unique resource for us, both in terms of being able to ask him, what is this little part about, or what do you feel about this music, or what do you think Bob thinks about this bit of music? Will you ask him for me? but also just having somebody that's so willing to then take the character even further because he is so comfortable in this part.
What is that like when you have what is essentially a new piece, but you have this person that has more familiarity than anybody else?
It's great. I mean, it's if Keith weren't so willing to re-explore, it might be challenging, but he's a great artist, and of course he is willing. And I actually apparently have a different take on the piece than the original production did. So Keith has been very interested in re-exploring the character with me. And because everybody else in the cast is making their debut, it's infused it with a really new energy for him. The relationship that he has with Sharon is very, very different in our production. So that, I think, has been really unique and interesting for him.
So what are your sort of different takes from previous productions? Give us a sense.
Original production, Sharon was held up much more, almost quite literally, as a saint. And Kirsten Chavez, who was last here as Sister Helen in Dead Man Walking, is much more interested in the woman behind Sharon Falconer. So she and I have been exploring what that conflict is like for Sharon, which is very true to the Sharon of the novel.
Because Sharon knew Elmer was Teflon.
Yes, and Sharon in the novel is also a little bit Teflon as well. She's a made-up character as well. She has invented the name Sharon Falconer and has sort of created this persona for herself, which is really interesting to think that they are something like birds of a feather. They understand each other in that way. But Sharon is also a woman who struggles with her calling and how much is she allowed to just be in love and pursue those aspects of her life. And is that a conflict with what she perceives to be God's mission for her?
So she's more of a three-dimensional character than some sort of icon, religious icon.
Yeah. And so that's given Keith, I think, more interesting stuff to play because we, in this production, believe very much in the veracity of their relationship, that they are actually passionately in love with each other. And that makes the end all the more tragic and, I would argue, all the more operatic.
Now, this piece is it's set up, I guess, almost like a Broadway show as far as the stage set and the fact that a lot of times an act will have a single set in which, you know, you move around in that set. But this is like scene changes while the piece is basically going
Indeed.
On.
Indeed. The first act is about an hour long and has six scenes in it. And the second act is a little bit shorter than that, actually, and has seven scenes. So we're constantly moving. And the opera itself is very episodic because the novel is. And it spans 11 years of Elmer's life and what happens in that intervening period of time. So it's very entertaining because you're never in one place for very long, constantly kind of shifting through all of these aspects of his life. It's a big story.
No, it's also a pretty big sing, especially for Elmer.
Yes, he doesn't really get to leave the stage, which Keith sort of remembered yesterday in the middle of a run-through. He looked at me and said, I now remember being tired.
And in fact, we're going to hear the opening of the opera, because unlike a lot of operas where you'll have an overture and you have a little bit of a warm-up, this jumps right in from, you know, there's 30 seconds, 30 seconds of music.
He sings. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What's that like energy wise for your cast? Because
it's great. I mean, it means that we're right in it. And the first thing that happens in the opera is Elmer is drunk in a bar telling a story to a group of drunk businessmen. And it's just a great way to start. And it's great. It energizes the chorus. It means we hit the ground running. And then in the very next scene, the chorus, they do a wickedly fast costume change. And all of those men have to come back and be the stuffy academics at this Bible college and seminary. So the audience is dropped right in the middle of this story. Literally, we start, you know, in the midst of things.
I would think this would be a pretty big choral opera.
It is. The chorus is very, very busy.
You have
the
college, you have
the bar. The seminary scene, the big revival scene.
The tabernacle.
And there's a huge scene set in an Elks Lodge as well. All the men of the chorus have to sort of put on their best kind of Rotary and Elks imitations and do some silly songs and stuff like that. So a lot has been asked of the chorus in this piece, but they have risen to the challenge. I think they're having great fun as well.
Well, let's hear the opening of Elmer Gantry. This is from the Nashville Opera production. Tulsa Opera is presenting Robert Aldred's opera Elmer Gantry this weekend. My guest today is Christine McIntyre, the stage director, as we hear the opening of Elmer Gantry. That's music from the opening of Elmer Gantry, which Tulsa Opera will be producing this weekend. The fairly new opera of Robert Aldrich. He's actually written, I guess, in the 1970s or 80s?
Yes, it took him a while to sort of finish it up, and then it took a long time to actually convince somebody to do it. Getting a new opera produced in this country can be a real challenge.
Yeah, it's funny. It either happened like all
right
of a
away,
sudden or it takes years.
Yeah.
Well, we're glad that this piece is coming to Tulsa Opera, to the Performing Arts Center this weekend. My guest today is the stage director, Christine McIntyre. This is her third time to visit Tulsa Opera. Having done two very traditional operas, now we get to see your contemporary chops, which is a big part of what you do.
It is indeed. It's something I really, really enjoy. My background is literature and theater, so whenever I can be put back in a more theatrical setting, I'm usually very, very happy on the opera stage. Doesn't mean I don't like the classics, but I've done a lot of American opera. I've done some world premieres, and I really enjoy the energy of doing something that is so fresh.
Now, when you do a world premiere, oftentimes you will have access, if they're still around, the composer and librettist. Have you had any access to Robert Aldridge and his librettist this particular time, or only through Keith Ferris?
We have through Keith, and he gets emails from them. And Herschel, the librettist, and I are actually friends on Facebook. They're coming for the final dress and for the performances, so the audience will have a chance to see and to meet them, which I think is great and so important.
So what are the sort of things you want to know from the mind of a composer or a librettist about their motivations on
a
particular
thing? Well, sometimes it's about... what is a little thing about? If we have a little problem corner in a scene, a little something that doesn't make sense, it's how do we negotiate this? Or maybe it's as simple as, what did you mean when you said that? Or what does this bit of music mean? How do we get from A to B? Because sometimes it's not clear, you know, and I don't have Giuseppe Verdi around to ask him when I run into trouble. But it's lovely when you have somebody around and you can just say, tell me how this is meant to work. Jake Hagee is a friend, and I do the same thing when I'm directing one of Jake's pieces, where I'll call him up and say, okay, Jake, I've got four questions, and I bet you have answers.
Now, is there any moments in the opera that said, well, why is this little interlude music here? What was the reason?
There was bits where in the original production they had cut a little bit of stuff, and the composer and the librettist came back to us and said, you know, we would really like you to do this bit because we think it's really good and really important, and we looked at it. It's a little Hebrew lesson that Frank, Elmer's best friend and kind of mentor, is giving him. This is right after the boys have been selling the farm implements, and they're studying for their afternoon Old Testament Hebrew class. And, of course, you get the sense that Elmer doesn't really care about Old Testament Hebrew, but Frank does. Frank is deeply theological and intellectual, and he's sort of been getting Elmer through school. And it's a really charming and interesting little scene during which they have an argument that's actually pretty important to their relationship. So Costis and I looked at the music and said, yeah, absolutely. They want it in. Let's do it. So that's been great to sort of put that back in and get closer to their original intention for that.
Now, for the cast members that this is their first production, what is the process for feeling out this opera? You mentioned earlier, you said we obviously go to source material. We go to related source material like Amy Semple McPherson. But as you're fleshing out the role, what are the sort of key things that you have to do with your singers?
Well, we sit and talk probably more than we do with other pieces where we're all a little more familiar. You know, I started out the process by all of us just sitting around the table, and I showed a lot of photographs and asked everybody what they thought about their characters. And in some cases, we asked Keith what his experience of those characters had been from the piece before, because he's the only person that had been through it. But in many cases, it's about what can I and this artist who is new to this part make of it? What direction should we take it? There's actually a lot of latitude. And I think that sometimes when we have 17th and 18th and 19th century opera, we feel ourselves to be constrained by the performance history. Certain choices have been made over time. When you're doing new work, that's just not true. And it really depends on what Kirsten Chavez or Peter Strummer want to do with a part. And that's a tremendous freedom for them. It's also a big responsibility.
Now, to me, the interesting character of this whole thing is Lulu Baines, you know, because she has the affair with Elmer. She moves on with her life, yet she can't let go.
She cannot let go.
Can you maybe talk about the thought process?
Sure. So when Elmer meets Lulu, she is the daughter of the president of the theological seminary, very much a daddy's girl, and she's engaged to marry another student who is kind of a nerdy putz. And Elmer is just about the best-looking thing she's ever seen. So she's immediately attracted to him. And the fact that he's interested in her, I think, kind of rocks her world. She has never felt the way that Elmer makes her feel. When we meet them again, they're having a sort of secret affair. And Elmer's already kind of tired of her, but he doesn't tell her that. The minute Elmer sees Sharon Falconer, he realizes his future is with Sharon. And then poor Lulu shows up. And Elmer literally throws her away and says, I'm moving on. I've got plans. And Lulu is, we suspect, heartbroken. The next time we see Lulu, she's actually married Eddie, the nerdy student. But it's very clear that this is a marriage that isn't really working and that Elmer is probably the reason. So I don't think it's that inconceivable that when her husband wants to bring down Elmer, that she would agree to the plan, which is that she is to seduce Elmer in a hotel room. Seems like a lot to ask your wife to do.
It does, doesn't it?
It does. And it's been a very tricky and interesting scene to explore.
I think it is the tricky part because the realistic is to let's try to forget about this.
Yeah.
And yet they can't. And in fact, they actively open the wounds.
Yeah. And in the course of staging the scene, it became obvious that the most interesting choice we could make for Lulu is that she, as much as she wants revenge on Elmer, she's also still deeply attracted to him. And so she's playing both sides of that. And it makes it a really complicated and interesting situation. And of course, at the end, then, in the big confrontation scene, she actually comes face to face with Sharon Falconer, the man who took Elmer from her, and realizes to her horror that Sharon is just another woman. And that she is as capable of feeling pain and sorrow as Lulu has been. So there's some really interesting opportunities for those two characters on stage at the same time.
I'd like to play a little more music. This is a very modern piece, but what is really interesting to me is the love scene between Sharon and Elmer, which is just this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful
music.
It is.
Nobody should be put off by thinking that modern opera equals ugly music.
No.
Because this piece is incredibly tuneful. And this love duet is in the great tradition of opera love duets.
And what was your thinking on staging this particular scene?
Well, as I said, we were really interested in exploring Sharon's conflict between what she thinks God has called her to do and the fact that as a woman, she's very attracted to Elmer. She's a little suspicious of him, as she should be. But Elmer's very charming and is also genuinely attracted to her. And they sort of make this strange agreement that he will sort of submit to her and her calling and she will submit to God and that will make it all okay. And they sort of find each other in the midst of this.
Well, let's hear music from Robert Aldridge's Elmer Gantry. This is the love duet between Sharon and Elmer, now on Studio Tulsa.
Oh, had I wings, Sharon,
music from the love duet from Elmer Gantry. Tulsa Opera is presenting that opera this weekend. My guest today is Christine McIntyre, the stage director for the production. I wanted to get at one thing that we haven't talked about, which is what Keith Ferris brings to the role. Mm-hmm. And Elmer's got to be attractive. He's got to be charming.
Mm-hmm.
And a slime at the same, and
absolutely.
A cad at the same time.
And Keith manages it in a remarkable way. Keith is himself extremely attractive and very charming. So all of those parts of Elmer, I think, come absolutely second nature to him. What perhaps does not is the fact that he's also a really, really, really nice guy and a really decent human being. But he understands that Elmer is a cad and is perfectly happy to sort of go there. I think that's fun for him. So in Keith, you also have somebody who is a consummate musician with a really, really beautiful voice. And anybody who has heard the Grammy-winning recording of this opera immediately understands that Keith has an awful lot to do with why it won a Grammy Award and why it was so successful. The richness of his voice is just an amazing thing. So it's a wonderful thing for us to have him here doing it, because I can really think of no better person to be playing Elmer. You can't pick somebody who is naturally a cad. You can't pick somebody whose natural role is Don Giovanni. That wouldn't work. You actually need somebody who is one of those guys that you kind of can't take your eyes off of in rehearsal, and Keith is very much that person.
And I guess the story basically makes the cad of him that he is, or...
Elmer is an opportunist, I think. You know, Keith and I had a great phone conversation where I said to him, so tell me your thoughts on Elmer. And he said, well, I think Elmer is not evil. He is not morally bad.
Morally bankrupt, maybe.
But he is morally bankrupt, and he is empty, and he allows himself to become whatever people need him to be. And one of the most interesting aspects of this story, and I think this is very true in the Sinclair Lewis novel as well, is that Elmer is a chameleon. And that people need and want things from him, and people enable him. And Elmer is clever enough to understand in any given situation exactly who he needs to be and how he needs to act. And the seminary scene is a perfect example. He is called in because he got into a bar fight, and he assumes he's about to be thrown out of college. And in fact, they're really, really pleased that he was in this bar fight because he was defending the Bible college as part of it. And what they realize is that Elmer will make a very good preacher because he's very charismatic and he's sort of willing to fight for the religion. And they say, we don't need mollycoddles. We need big, strong men. And they offer him a scholarship. And of course, Elmer has never thought of the notion of having a scholarship to Bible college. But suddenly he realizes, well, be a free meal ticket for a couple of years and he could do this preaching thing. And he says, it's not that I don't believe in God, but you know, you get some money, they give you a church, lots of pretty women sitting in the front row looking up at you, why not? I'd be pretty good at it. And he makes it sound so reasonable that you actually begin to see it from his perspective and you think, well, there's nothing wrong with that, right? Until you actually take a step back and kind of assess it from a moral standpoint. But it's interesting because they're getting what they need as well. And so I think in a way, it's an opera that makes everybody suspect and really makes us as a public question our motives and the trust we place in these people and how ready we are to go along with somebody
gullibility.
Who is like Elmer. Absolutely.
Yeah.
We are all gullible. The final tabernacle scene actually makes the audience as culpable as anybody else in the story.
In what way?
Well, the way the scene was conceived, the audience for the Tabernacle Revival is not the chorus on stage as they were in the first act tent scene. It's actually the actual opera audience sitting in the house. And we've staged it that there's some action out in the house, that the house lights will come up partially as part of it, which means that we are all complicit in this story in some way, which I think is very true.
Well, it sounds like you're having a lot of fun with this production.
We are.
Yeah. Elmer Gantry runs this weekend at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. My guest today is Christine McIntyre, stage director, who is doing an awful lot of work. I mean, from here you go to New Orleans. What's special coming up on your calendar? I mean, obviously this opera.
This
having
is
a chance
great.
To I'm, do a pretty new opera.
Yeah. That... After this I do a Bohème, but then I do two productions of Dead Man Walking back to back. So that's great. I was actually at the premiere of Dead Man in 2000. I used to work at the San Francisco Opera, and Jake Hagee's been a friend since before he wrote it. So that will be great. And then after that, I'm actually doing a world premiere in Portland, a new opera about an Afghan war vet and his wife living in Louisiana during Katrina and what happens to the two of them. So there's a lot of sort of exciting 20th century and 21st century stuff that I get to be working on.
Let's talk a little bit about new opera because, you know... This has been the last 20 years has been a fertile time for new operas.
Very much so.
But the Dead Man Walkings are the exception rather than the rule of more than maybe a few token performances. How important is this particular production? Because this is the third production.
I think it's really key. You know, it's not that hard to get somebody to do a world premiere because there's a lot of publicity to it, the sense of something
new. It kind of sells tickets itself.
It does, you know, and it's a really unique experience for the audience. And when I've been at one, you see that the people in the audience understand that they're at a unique event. What is almost impossible is to get a piece produced the second, the third, the fourth time until in that weird space between its premiere and it becoming part of the operatic canon. Dead Man managed it, and Dead Man is now, I think, part of our modern operatic canon. But the period in between was the scary part. And there are other Hagee operas that have struggled to get to that point. And I've actually worked on some of them in the sort of second and third productions of them. So it's hugely significant that Costis has brought this piece here to say, this is worthy and we should continue to do this piece so that we will be helping it on its journey to becoming part of the modern American canon.
Yeah, well, so I think it's great about that. It's also great that there are a lot of people writing new operas, but
absolutely.
Boy, those second productions after the initial, and sometimes it's, you know, two or three productions in different cities. That's part of the world of opera, but beyond that opening production, it's really difficult to
get
a second.
It is, and I remember Opera America does a new works workshop every year, and one year I was actually staging some scenes from it, and composers basically submit scenes and ask to be considered for it. And one of the scenes that was submitted was American Tragedy, which had had its premiere at the Metropolitan Opera. And I remember looking at it going, why does that need to be in the Opera America scenes program? And the response was, because no one else will do it now. And he was desperate to get people to reexamine it and think that it could be done outside of the Met and in a smaller context and all of that. And I thought that was so fascinating and really telling and a little sad that having had a premiere at the Metropolitan Opera didn't necessarily mean that American Tragedy was going to get done a lot. And it sort of made me as a director realize the importance of doing stuff that isn't just the sort of shiny, exciting new world premiere, but of finding the works out there that have been successful and continuing to add to their success.
Well, we wish you great success with those world premieres later this season and, of course, with Elmer Gantry.
Thank you very much.
Christine, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Christine McIntyre is the stage director for Tulsa Opera's production of Elmer Gantry, which takes place this Friday evening at 7:30 and Sunday afternoon at 2:30 in the Chapman Music Hall of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. For more information, visit tulsaopera.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.